Morning.
Good morning.
And good morning. So today, right now. You could all come back tomorrow and I give the talk, I suppose. Today, right now, I'm going to talk about a stanza from the Genjo Koan that I've actually talked about before. So probably some of you could actually give this talk, but you have to have been around for a long time to be able to give it, because I have to give it because I haven't talked about it that recently. The Genjo Koan by Dogen. We spent 6 weeks in our morning study groups studying the Genjo Koan by Dogen. Dogen, the Zen teacher, lived in the 13th century. And you can see what I'm going to talk about by looking in your program. I'm going to talk about the stanza, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be identified by all life. One of a multiplicity of translations. To forget the self is to be identified by all life. To forget the self is to be identified with all life. To forget the self is to be authenticated by all life. To forget the self is to be confirmed by all life. These are different translations. To forget the self is to be intimate with all life. Got it? Sounds nice, doesn't it? Okay. So, to study Buddhism is to study the self. Socrates said, the unexamined life is unworth living. And I believe it. I believe it. I believe that many of us, if not most of us, spend most of our lives in kind of a daze, from the Buddhist point of view, in a daze. Maybe not from your point of view, in a daze. Dazed about what we should be doing, about some criticism someone did of us, and churning it over and over and over again, about what we might have been or should have been. People are always asking me these questions about, well, what if such and such had happened? What would it be like then? We can go on. It's all right to speculate for a little bit, but we go on and on about this. So what if such and such had happened? This is what's happened. Let's take care of it. Let's be with it. Let's study it. Let's look at it. Let's examine it with some intention to see if there's something more than just this daze, this monkey mind daze. This monkey mind sometimes is very slow. When it's sated with lots of bananas and pineapples, it's very slow. And we think, oh, cool. Still the same monkey mind. Then it gets hungry. Then see it go from tree to tree. I have spent time on an island in the Caribbean. There aren't very many monkeys, but they find all the trees. And they only take one bite of each. Oh, I'll take one bite out of this, one bite out of that, so they destroy all of the fruit. That's what we do. We destroy everything with our anxiety and our needing to get stuff and needing to protect ourselves. So we're just poor monkeys. So to study Buddhism, to really look at what we do, is to study the self, to study what the self does, how it gets itself in trouble, how it gets its needs met, how it tries to get along in the world, to study it. And of course, we have an unusual way of studying the self here in the Zen tradition. We study the self by sitting and looking at a wall. That's how we study it. No books, no TV, nada. Oh, or you could look at the center of the room if you want. In Rinzai, they look at the center of the room. Okay, look at the center of the room. So that's where we're a little bit different from Socrates, maybe. A little bit different. And we know the stories of our heroes, of our mythical heroes in Buddhism, when they began to really examine their lives. When Buddha really began to examine his life, supposedly 28 years old, and he just overwhelmed by the suffering that he saw in the world around him. Just overwhelmed by it. Had no idea. And felt that he wasn't doing anything to be part of that. He didn't know how to deal with that. He got so despairing by the suffering that he was immobilized. And that was that when he saw his three sights: sickness, old age, and death. But then he saw the sannyasin. He didn't even know what the word sannyasin meant. It means holy person. He saw this kind of beatific guy. He just happened to see him when he was passing on the road. And he thought, oh, and he asked people who he was, and they said, oh, he's a sannyasin. And what's a sannyasin? A sannyasin is someone who's dedicating their lives to studying the self. Of course, this is in Hinduism, so studying the self in Hinduism is looking at the jiva, the ego, and seeing how the ego is a distortion of Atman, big self. But Buddha didn't care about that vocabulary. He just wanted to do it. So he took off. Took off. And for 6 years, supposedly, did it. Really worked on it. And Dogen, our other hero for the morning. Dogen lost his dad, and then he lost his mom before adolescence. So pre-adolescence, he lost both of the people he really loves and really support him. And he said, geez, isn't there something more than this? And he was hanging out with Buddhist monks. They were all around him. And they said, yes, you have the Buddha nature. Well, what's that? So he set off on his search, on his study. That's when he was an adolescent. This doesn't happen too often, right? Even in post-adolescence, it doesn't happen too often. But he was an unusual guy. He was an unusual guy. So, story I haven't told in a while, except to the beginning group, is the story of the college teachers who come to meet with the Zen master and learn about Zen, and they come and they have a lot of questions and they ask him a lot of questions. They're really interested in question after question after question, and then his attendant comes in with the tea for everybody, because you know that's, you always have tea. One thing about Japanese Zen is there's plenty of tea. There's always time for tea, and it's done in this beautiful way, this way that makes you feel real good. So the attendant brings in the tea, and you know, it's done very delicately. It's poured just so. The bowls are done in this nice raku pottery way, which isn't too perfect, but it's just really alive. So the attendant gives the tea to pour, and the teacher, you know, bows. Everybody bows, and then he pours it very, very steadily and delicately. And for those of you who know the story, what happens? He gets to the top, and he keeps pouring. Very dignified. And of course, it just goes all over everything. And one of the college teachers says, "Oh, look, you pouring the tea all over everything. You're overflowing the cup." Here in this nice, beautiful Japanese tea ceremony. And the teacher said, "Yes, yes, the cup is overflowing. I'm overflowing the cup. Just as with all of your thoughts and your ideas, your cups are overflowing. If you want to know what Zen is, you need to empty your cup." And then he said, "I'll show you how to use this. Come into the next room, I'll show you how to use this. No more questions until you've done this." That's the story, right? So, that's why we do this. That's why we do this practice. practice. And when we study the self, it's not that easy. It's not an easy practice. Not an easy practice. Because all kinds of things come in. Always come in. We have nothing to distract us. So things are coming in. We're totally permeable. We want to be impermeable through our great concentration. Good luck. Good luck. You've got nothing to protect you. You've got no television, no books, no conversation, except your internal conversation. Well, of course, you use your internal conversation a lot when you're sitting facing the wall. But ultimately, it doesn't go too far, does it? And you can just be with it in stillness. Just be with it and not be taken by it. It's possible. It's possible. It's been done before. It'll be done again. And not just by some exceptional human beings, by regular human beings. So similarities between intellectual study, and there are some, and our kind of study, is that we're both looking for truth, for some truth in our study. We're looking for some truth. The truth of self-forgetfulness and identity with life, with all of life. And in intellectual pursuit, we're looking for some truth too. Maybe not exactly that truth. That's usually a more specific, precise, delineated truth. And both require discipline. All the years I spent in school required just as much discipline as Zazen, a different kind of discipline, just as much discipline. And commitment, huge commitment. Intellectual study. And of course we do intellectual study in Buddhism too. We do it, but we only do it to help us in this process of forgetting the self and returning to our identity with all of life. So actually the word for study in Japanese has a different, little different connotation than in English, because it also means to repeat over and over again. You know, in an intellectual study, you get, I'll do Dogen now, and I'll do it. I got tired of Dogen now, I'll do, you know, Philip Kaplow. He's so exciting. Well, now, Philip Kaplow was exciting, but I didn't really have that great experience, so now I'll go to something else. But with Zazen, we repeat over and over. Can be kind of boring. But if you want to penetrate one thing, you have to become that one thing you're penetrating. And that means over and over and over. And minimizing the judging. In intellectual study, judging, evaluating, all the time, judging, evaluating. It's part of it. It's part of it. If you're going to do it well, you have to. In Zazen, minimize it. Now, I don't say don't do it at all. Everybody does some. Everybody does some, but you have to minimize it. Because if you don't minimize it, then your monkey mind is just doing the whole thing. You're just evaluating your Zazen the whole time. You might as well not even be sitting. Go home and watch TV, you know. I'm sure there's a good show on. Well, not on Sunday morning, but, well, maybe if you've got cable, there's a good TV. Look at all the VCR options, et cetera, right? So minimize judging and evaluating. And I'll say this to you, but it won't. I don't know if it'll help. I don't think it'll. Don't get discouraged by failure. Don't get discouraged by failure. This is not easy, and you will fail if you do it with wholehearted intention. You will fail. Don't get discouraged. Over and over and over. So to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. That's the part we want. Oh, wow. And of course, we've all known that. We've all had that experience, whether we're Zen or not Zen, right? Starting with, well, I was in my hometown because my father died, and I was in my hometown just, 10 days ago. Well, I happened to go by the house in my hometown where my first girlfriend lived. Talk about forgetting the self. Just driving by her house. Woo! And how many years ago was this? How many years ago? Oh, I said to Linda, I want to go buy that house again. She said, why do you want to go buy that house? I said, I'm not telling. But then I told her. Because it was so many years ago. I don't even know if the woman's alive or dead. So we know about forgetting the self from adolescence. And, of course, adolescent self-forgetfulness is pretty spacey. Not to pick on adolescents. Pretty spacey. And it's certainly not identifying with all of life, is it? Very seldom. Very seldom. But then there's more mature self-forgetfulness. Being a parent. Being a parent, if you're going to be a good parent, especially mothers do this better than fathers, I think. Maybe because flesh of my flesh, whereas for me it's not exactly that. But self-forgetfulness, really, really evident in parenthood. And my daughter, an example of my daughter. I have a grandson who is only 2 years old, and my daughter I just see her forgetting about her own needs to take care of him. Just forgetting. Just, I remind her, geez, you only got that much sleep. And she said, oh, is that right? Well, she doesn't even know. She doesn't even know. And she was never like that. She was never like that. But she's not the daughter that I had before, but because of her love for him, her caring for him, she just does that. She's forgotten the self. So we can do this in different aspects of our lives. Musicians, artists do it too, although they struggle with it. Poets do it too, although they struggle with it. We have the ability to do this, but usually it's pretty object-dependent for us. We're dependent on our kids. We can forget ourselves and our kids. And what happens when our kids grow up and our kids are gone? We haven't really... It's been a self-forgetfulness in which there's been some kind of dependency or codependency, which is not bad. It's a step in the right direction. At least it gives you a taste of it. And you can really help a child if you're there for them self-forgetfully. It's just that you need to know that it's not enough. You need to practice. You need to practice some kind of meditation. I don't care whether you practice Zen meditation or Buddhist meditation, but practice something in which you see this monkey mind and you begin to experience that this monkey mind is not you. It's you, but it's not you. I mean, you just think it's you and then there's a little bit of not you. But it's mostly not you. It's just a movie. Just a movie, just good theater, just bad theater, just boring theater, just comedy, just tragedy. Tragedy, yes. I hear about your tragedies, and I don't hear about your comedies when you come to see me one-to-one. I hear more about your tragedies. I know. I have those tragedies, too. So, in our sitting, we have a chance, an opportunity to see the fictional nature of this internal commotion, the fictional nature of it. And we have to really slow down to see that fictional nature. Not stop, but slow down enough so we can see it. So we can just see it. And that's the freedom that comes. There's it. Freedom isn't later. It's in that scene. In that scene. So another story I haven't told in a while, except to the beginning group. So this is China in probably 8th, 9th century China. 8th, 9th century China, the monks and nuns are separated. The monks live in one compound and the nuns live in another. And everybody says, why? I mean, we're so American. Why? Why would they do that? Well, they say that if the monks and nuns hang out together, there'll be too much monkey mind activity of a sexual nature, which could go beyond monkey mind activity. So during meditation times, we don't really need that. It's not necessary. So the monks are there and the nuns are there. Of course, in China, the nuns don't have the stature of monks, which is a very sad but true historical fact. Anyway, so we have two monks coming from their monastery during the rainy season. Rainy season is when we do retreats. Going back to Buddhist time, we do retreats in rainy season. Now here, you know, we all have our lives, but it's rainy season when there's time historically to just go inside, to just sit, to do long sessions, long retreats. But that's in a pre-industrial society. In our society, you know, we do it when we can. So it's a rainy season. So they've been in retreats, and the monks are in one area, and the nuns are in another. At least 5 miles apart. That's the norm. 5 miles apart, so there won't be any hanky panky going on, right? You don't want hanky panky going on when you're right in the middle of a session. You may have it internally, but not externally. You're going to have it internally. So the monks come out, and the nun comes down to this river. And there's one place across the river where the water is usually shallow. But it's a rainy season, so the water is huge, really high. And monks are really tall monks, like 6'3½". 6'8½". 6'3½" used to be tall when I was a kid. Now 6'8½", I guess. and the nun is 4'11½". Right? You can look it up. 4'11½". And so they get to the stream together, and the first monk picks up the nun and puts her on her shoulders and carries her across the stream, because it's obvious she couldn't go across. The stream is very high, and he has to weigh it. It's waist high, above his waist. And then he puts her down, and the second monk goes across the stream with him. And then they put her down, and they both go their ways. And the second monk says to the first monk, and some of you can tell this story, because I've told it so many times, although not in a while. The second monk says to the first monk, how dare you pick that woman up and put her on your shoulders and take her across the stream? You know this is practice period, and we're not allowed to talk with monks, with nuns, much less touch them or put them on our shoulders. And the first monk said, what did he say? Those of you who know the story, what did he say?
I put her down.
Yeah. Oh, is she still on your shoulders? I put her down when we left the stream. So that's just another story about emptying the self, about putting down our burdens. This is what this practice is about. But the problem is that we cannot consciously put down our burdens. We have to have downtime. We have to have quiet time. Whether you sit in this zendo or not, it doesn't matter. But you have to have some disciplined downtime where there's nothing but just you and the sky or you and the wall. It's the only way, unless you're some phenomena. But even Buddha, he was a phenomena. Even Dogen, took him a few years. So I've talked recently about Katagiri Roshi. And I happen to remember, I guess it was yesterday when I was thinking about this talk, going in to see Katagiri Roshi when he had cancer and he was in the hospital. I actually hadn't seen him in a while, in some time. And I went with my friend Paul to see him in the hospital. And this was 35 years after I had met him. Because I'm old, you guys. Probably, I don't know, 35 or so years after I'd met him. And when I met him 35 years ago, Suzuki Roshi, my first teacher, was making him give talks. This is what we do. If you decide you're going to become a Zen teacher, if you're going to become get trained to be a Zen teacher, then you have to give talks. It's just what we've been doing for a couple thousand years. Well, the cause, obviously. Talking is one way we help people. And so you need to practice doing it. Yeah. So I went to see him in the hospital. Oh, no. So I first year I knew him, after about a year, Suzuki Roshi started telling him, "You give this talk." And Katagiri Roshi's English was not good. Suzuki Roshi's English was not good either, but there's bad and there's worse, right? And poor Katagiri Roshi, I would come in and see him before his talk, and he'd be shaking like a leaf. And I thought, gee, I don't know. I thought Zen was supposed to calm you down. But wait until you have to give a talk if you think that's the case. Wait. I don't care how good your practice is, how deep your practice is. Wait. And he was shaking like a leaf. And I saw him talk after talk for the first couple of years, shaking like a leaf and very not wanting to do it. And I saw the same with Chino-sensei, not wanting to do it. Chino-sensei would guzzle tea. But he would think that would calm him down. I don't know where I thought that is a strange idea that it's going to calm him down. He would have me into his room, Chino sensei, and he would mix up the ceremonial tea what nights he had to give talks, froth it up. It's very strong if you've had it, and it just sends you flying. Talk about monkey mind. This is beyond monkey mind. This is dragon mind. And then he would go in and give these talks at Tassajara. And the poor man was just beside himself. Anyway, so that was when I first met Katagiri Roshi. 35 years later, I come in to see him in the hospital room. He's suffering from cancer. And he's so calm. He's so composed. He's so friendly. And he's so sweet with all of his cancer. And talking to me about Dogen. Because I, in a just very gentle way. So there's an example of a lot of years of practice and how you really will transform yourself. But you have to keep monkey mind out of it in terms of evaluation, pretty much. 90% out. When you can meet with me anytime and then I can do some evaluation if you want. I mean, I wouldn't force it on you, but I can help you do some evaluation. So to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And after a while, we get tired of studying the self. We want to do something else. Come on, give me a break. How long have I been doing this? One thing to have a half-day session, but a whole day? 2 days? 7 days? Are you crazy? I can barely get through 30 minutes of meditation. I'm trying to do 30 minutes once a week. So it's we lose our aspiration because it just seems either too hard or we don't need it anymore. And that's when we fall into the realms. The realms. Bonnie helped me prepare for my talk the other day. People ask me questions, then that they have to watch out because yeah. So the six realms, which I've been talking about a lot lately, right? The hell realm, which is these are psychological realms in Zen. Now, if you go to some fundamentalist Buddhism, they talk about them as physical realms, which, and after death and all that stuff. We're only interested in right here, mostly. So, for us, they're psychological realms. Hell realm, anger and hatred. Hungry ghost realm. Neediness, not enough, I can't get satisfaction, I can't get support, I can't get my act together, I can't, I need, I want. Animal realm, sex and food and comfort. Human realm is the fourth realm. Fifth realm is fighting spirit realm. I want to be the best. I want to be there aren't any other Zen teachers here, but let's get all the Zen teachers together and see who can be the best. Duke it out, right? duke it out by being nice to each other, because that's what you do in spiritual circles, you know. That's an old spiritual tradition, which my grandmother told me about. In all religions. Watch out for that tradition. So, but only in the human realm, the fourth realm, is there a fairly equal amount of pain and pleasure. A fairly equal amount that helps you practice, that keeps you inspired to practice. And if your practice is slacked off, or if you hadn't started your practice, you're probably hanging out most of your time in those other realms, one or more of them. In the lower realms, there's too much pain. There's too much suffering. There's too much heartbreak. There's too much dismay to practice in the lower realms. And when you do practice, it's just self-torture. You sit facing the wall and it's just self-torture. And in the upper realms, it's too good. You don't need it, right? I don't need that stuff. Okay, so I'll talk about myself now for a minute. As if I don't always do that. This one I haven't talked about, I think. But Bonnie helped me. So I've been practicing a long time, right? And my first teacher was Suzuki Roshi, and I practiced with him for 5 years. And then at the end of that 5 years, I left. And I left because... why did I leave? I left because I'd seen through Monkey Mind. Monkey Mind had stopped completely its machinations, and then it continued. But I didn't identify it with anymore. I identified with everything. I'd gone through some incredible transformation, so I didn't need it. I didn't need it. But as soon as you say you don't need something, watch out. Watch out. I'd seen through the fictional self. How can I see through this fictional self? How can I? Oh, I saw through the fiction. Oh, that was a good one. That was a good one. So, I was in a God realm, right? Oh, I don't need to be here. These people are doing all this bowing and shaving all these heads and... all this stuff. I don't need to be here. Let's go, Linda. And she said, good. I won't get into that. Let's go. So we left. We left. And we, for some bizarre reason, came from California to Minnesota. What happens if you're in a God realm? What's the realm that you fall into next, usually? Tell me.
Hell
realm. Yep. People in God realms generally go right into hell realms. They can sustain the God realm for a while, but they don't. They go right to, in Monopoly it says, do not pass something or other, go right to something or other. How does that go?
Go right to jail.
Go right to jail. Oh, yeah, do not pass.
$200.
So, right to the hell realm. And there here I am in Minnesota. Excuse me, you guys. Sorry. Northern Minnesota, no less. And I grew up in San Francisco. And there I am. And it is a hell realm, internally and externally. But, you know, there I was, blissed out, one with the universe. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. You should study with some of these Rinzai teachers. Then you'll really be one with the universe. So that was the first time I left. But you know, I'm not a very good boy. I left the second time. So finally I got my act back together up there, way up there. I found someone to sit with because I couldn't sit by myself. You see, so many of you guys sit by yourselves. I don't know how you maintain it. I couldn't maintain it. I don't know how you do it. You have strength that I never had. I could not maintain it by myself. But finally I found some guy. I didn't exactly talk him into it, but a little bit talked him into it. And then I sat with him. And so I was able to get back into the human realm. Get back in the human realm. And then Katagiri Roshi moved to Minneapolis, and then I moved down here and I started practicing again, with him formally. And I did that from about 75, well, about for about 10 years I did that, about 10 years. And during that 10 years, well, I think during the in the third year I was ordained as a priest, and then I began giving talks here. He would have me give talks, just like Suzuki Roshi made him give talks. I probably shook too. I don't remember. I must have. And I kept practicing, and I taught classes, and then other people got ordained too. And then after about 8 or so years, I began. I didn't realize this till afterwards. I began feeling a little resentful. It was like I was waiting for Katagiri Roshi to do Vatican II with Zen, the Zen equivalent of Vatican II for those of you who are Catholics. Instead, he was emphasizing all of these robes, and it seemed like a lot of robes to me, but that's just my bias, right? And all of these accoutrements and all doing something like this and like that. And I began to feel resentful. And I thought, geez, I don't need that. And I'm getting older. And I also began, I think, in retrospect, it took me a few years to even realize this. You know how we suppress stuff, right? We repress stuff. I was even a little jealous, I think, of... A lot of people would come to me, but more people came to him. And you got to pay attention to these things. I still have to pay attention to this as a Zen center, as a Zen teacher. It's how much ego involvement do I have? And I'm going to have some, so I'm going to feel bad when someone I have a relationship with leaves. But do I have to turn that into jealousy? Can I see that realm before I do anything? Before I turn it into a new monkey mind activity? And in the human realm, you can. You can. So then I left again, right? I left again. And now here I am back. I've been back for what? 12 years, I don't know. 10, 12 years. And now, next time I leave, it's when I die, you guys. And hopefully that's not going to be for a while, but I don't know. I don't know. So, the realms. And the lower realms, I don't have examples from the lower realms. You guys, I'm sure, have examples from the lower realms. How you get stuck in them. How you get stuck in them. So the reason you have a teacher, the reason you have a sangha, is to help you get back to the human realm, where there's you get your aspiration back, you get your inspiration back. In the lower realms, there's too much pain, there's too much heartache. And in the upper realms, you're either got the high of beating other people out, which is the fighting spirit realm, or the high of having your cake and eating it too, which is the God realm. In either case, it's good to have a teacher and a community to help you deal with those and help you see them. Help you acknowledge those realms. So to study the Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be identified by all life. And that's early in the Genjo Koan he says that, and then later he has an explanatory comment, a metaphorical comment about what he means by to be identified by all life. He says, when a person attains realization, it is like the moon reflecting on the water. The moon never becomes wet. The water is never destroyed. Although it is a vast and great light, it reflects itself on a small amount of water. The whole moon and even the whole sky reflects on even a drop of dew on a blade of grass, or a single tiny drop of water. Realization does not destroy the person, as the moon does not make a hole in the water. The person does not obstruct realization, as a drop of dew does not obstruct the moon in the sky. So that's Dogen's metaphorical expression. He has lots of metaphorical expressions. So when I was talking about this last time I talked about it, somebody said to me, "Oh, well, then that second monk in the story of the two monks and the nuns, that second monk who is there for the nun, who helps her in spite of isn't caught up by the rules in his head and still sees her neediness and helps her, then he's an example in that instance of identification with all life or intimacy with all life." And yes, but not on the next minute. On the next minute, he's in a god realm or a fighting spirit realm, because he puts the other monk down. He does it in a beautiful spiritual way, right? But beware of these beautiful spiritual put-downs. In a beautiful spiritual way, he says, "Oh, is he still on your shoulders? I put him down when I left the stream. Is that identifying with all of life?" I would say it's dissing. Big time. Big time. That's not our practice. That's practice in those other realms, in the fighting spirit realm, in the God realm, but not our practice. When we see ourselves doing that, we don't have to do shame. Just see it and then let it go. Let it go. But you have to see it first. You have to see it first. And the way to do that is what I've just been saying. Zazen. Meditation. It's the first leg of Buddha. And the second leg of Buddha, if Buddha is going to stand up, you guys know this who've studied with me, the second leg of Buddha is behavior. Ethical, moral behavior. Now, even if that second monk was in a good state. I mean, he really was the first monk, when he helped the person. He helped that woman. He was in a good state of mind when he helped her. He was able to let go of everything. But then with the second monk, he didn't. But if he had just seen what he was doing, that would have helped. So I'm gonna close with a comment by William Blake. William Blake says about spirituality, and you know, William Blake was very trippy. He's very un-Zen in many ways, because you know, he's a Western shaman is what he is. He's always being visited by spirits and angels and gods, but he's also very profound. I would call him kind of a Zen shaman, and he says that there's only one thing that's necessary for spiritual life: to do good in minute particulars. To do good in minute particulars. So that's the second leg of Buddha. Buddha means awake. Buddha means self-forgetfulness and identification with all life, intimacy with all life. To support Buddha, we need zazen, meditation, and action, behavior that's ethical, that's moral, that's in accord with our deep values of interdependence, our deep values. And you need both those legs. And anytime you think you don't need those legs, then you should just go back to the beginning again. Come see me, and if it's me, I should go see someone else. And I will. Okay, I think that's what I want to say. So what would you like to say? Or ask about, or whatever?
So, how would you think that the first monk should have responded to the second?
Well, I think, I think the first monk, I mean, you know, we're just being speculative here, right? Yeah. This is just a story, probably just all made up anyway. But I think, in a still mind, in an open, if your mind is still, your heart is open. And so you might say, I might say, if you said this to me, I might say, gee, Dan, sorry to pick on you, Dan, but you're here. Maybe I just should do Susan, just ask me the question. Gee, Dan, it sounds like you're really upset that I violated those rules, which you think are so important for maintaining our Zazen mind. And I want to apologize for having upset you. But I thought she really needed help, and I didn't know what else to do. And we did get her. I did get her across the stream, but I'm sorry. Next time I don't know if I'll say it next time because I don't want her to. I don't know what I'll. But I would at least say that. I would not one up. There's enough. We one up in everything. Do we have to one up in Zen too?
Yes.
Oh, one of my students. You may be one-upping me yet. Where's your sword, Ben?
I agree with that person who said yes.
Pardon?
That was out of a sense of humor.
Oh, out of a sense of humor is cool. Yeah. I'm just speculating on the context. If it was out of a sense of humor, then fine. Yeah. Then fine. Yeah. Yeah. Lighten it up. Add some levity to it.
That's why it's a story that keeps getting told. It's funny.
Yeah.
And that's why, and it entertains, and that's
yeah, that's right.
The best teaching tool.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Zen and the art of humor. Well, I'm serious. I'm seriously humorous about this. The more you practice, if you really engage in this practice, the more the less you'll be drawn to the tragedy of life and the more to the humor. Because right in those Shakespearean tragedies, there's great humor. If you do Shakespeare, you'll find great humor right in the middle of those tragedies. Because Shakespeare knew. I mean, he may not have known psychically. He must have known psychically. He must have known psychically. Yes. Yeah.
I wonder how that works then alongside this other strand of the practice, which is not assigning good or bad to things, but taking away the judgment. How do you?
Yeah, that's a good point. You guys could hear her, right?
Yeah.
That's always a good point. So in our meditation practice in particular, we're not assigning good or bad. Now, I would qualify that and say that if you're sitting every morning and you're 90% planning your day or 90% reviewing your last romantic encounter, just come see me and we'll talk. Because there should be a little bit of evaluation going on. A little bit of evaluation, but not much. Because in your sitting practice, as my teacher Suzuki Roshi said, you have to put the bread in the oven and not keep opening the oven door. If you keep opening the oven door, the bread never bakes. And it gets hard, but it never lightens up. It never lightens up. So that's in your meditation practice. But in your daily life, we have what we call the precepts. And those have to do with speech, the way we speak, the way we act. And they're very similar to the Ten Commandments, only they're not commandments in Buddhism. They're ways in which we manifest our identity with all of life. Even if we don't know it, we manifest it by trying to be honest in our relationships, by trying not to take things from people in our relationships. So that part is equally important. Does that make sense? Anything else this morning, you guys? Yeah.
I guess I just can't put the second mark down.
Huh?
In the story, doesn't it end with the second monk becoming greatly enlightened? That, you know, he hears what this other monk is saying, and it.
Oh, not in my version. But of course, if the second monk becomes greatly enlightened, then the first monk is doing it in a teaching way, in a way that's not putting him down, and you know. So we don't know. These are just fabricated stories. But in your way, yeah, in your way, it was cool what the first monk did, but still, be careful about telling people something you've got that they don't. Mm-hmm. Be careful about that. That's all. And if he did it in this light, friendly way, and the guy got in line, that's great. That's cool.
Mentioned the precepts, going back to where he was in following the precepts when those words came from his mouth.
Right, exactly. Exactly, yes. We need to interview the guy.
Right.
Well, go find him and
do
a reality TV. Anything else? Thank you.